From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I have a special episode for you guys today. I am joined by a fellow true crime podcaster that has a very specific niche of true crime that she covers. Her name is CJ, and she is the host of the Rainbow Crimes podcast, formerly Beyond the Rainbow. When did you make that change, CJ?
Oh, I just decided to do it for the new year, actually.
Oh, so just now, after about 5 years of running the podcast.
Yes. I was asking my listeners, I said, you know, I'm feeling a little stagnant and I'd like to, you know, maybe rebrand a little bit. What do you guys think if I change the name? And I presented them a logo that one of my fellow Darkcast Network shows came up with on AI. Uh-huh. And they loved it. So I'm all, okay, let's go with that then and see if we can spruce things up a little bit.
Yeah, the AI stuff is crazy right now. I teach broadcasting at our local high school. And they're creating logos for their podcast. And a few of them are like, well, look, Mr. Ruff, you can go right on AI and they'll just build the logo for you.
Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really neat. So CJ, tell us a little bit about yourself. So you've been doing the podcast now for about 5 years. Well, before we get into how you started the podcast, I think, why don't you share what Rainbow Crimes is all about? What's your podcast about?
Rainbow Crimes, previously Beyond the Rainbow, is about true crime of the LGBTQ community. And I cover crimes against LGBTQ people and crimes by LGBTQ people.
Okay. And how often do you do episodes?
I drop once a week an episode, usually.
Okay. So what made you get into podcasting? To get into podcasting in general, but also the specific genre of podcasting and that niche of just the LGBTQ community?
Well, truthfully, I grew up in Sacramento, California, and that's home of a lot of serial killers. When I was little, I had a phone call, and I used to run to the phone to beat all my family members when the phone rang. I don't know, it was some game I played, and I was probably 6 or 7. I got to the phone first, and there was a man's voice on the other end saying horrible sexual and things that he was going to kill me. Just horrible, terrible things. And I remember dropping the phone, screaming and crying. My mom came to the phone, picked it up. Nobody was on the other end. I totally forgot about that. She told me at the time, she told me it was just the teenage boy across the street. He had a friend over. They were pranking me. And, you know, it didn't sound like that. It sounded like a grown man's voice. And I just left it at what she had told me to comfort me. And I totally forgot about it for years and years and years. And then when the Golden State Killer was captured, because he was out and about in my area when I was little, I knew him as the East Area Rapist.
Mm-hmm.
From the news and stuff like that. But I was listening to some audio of a phone call he had made to one of his victims. As soon as I heard his voice, everything from my childhood came flooding back.
Oh, wow.
And it made me believe that he was the man on the other end of the phone when I picked up as a child. And my mom was pretty hot back then. So I wouldn't doubt that, you know, maybe he was trying to get a hold of her. And my dad, he's a sweetheart and would have been probably considered kind of a weaker man, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of what the Golden State Killer went after. Women with weaker men that he could manipulate. All that in my head made me think, yeah, that's who that was when I was a little girl.
What year was that?
Oh, I don't even remember, to be honest. And I can't remember my exact age. And I also lie about my age, so I couldn't be honest with you.
You don't look a day.
If I was older.
You don't look a day over 29. That was.
Oh, hey, thanks. That's what I tell everyone.
Yeah.
Every birthday, I'm 29 again. Woo! Yeah. So with having all of that in my backyard and Dorothea Puentes, she was another serial killer from our area. Richard Chase, the Sacramento vampire. We had so much true crime. I kind of was interested in it as a child. But then I kind of lost interest in it and got involved in other things in my life. As an adult, I was doing a lot of walking with my dogs and stuff. And a friend from high school asked me, do you ever listen to podcasts? And I'm all, no, I don't even know what that is. And this was probably about 7 years ago when I was living in Hawaii. And she was telling me, and she said, oh my God, do you like true crime? And I said, yeah, it really interests me. And she said, you have to listen to some of these. And she gave me a list of true crime podcasts to listen to on my walks. And it really filled the time as I was walking the dogs. Mm-hmm. And I would really get into the cases. So that's what got me into true crime podcasting. I would listen, like Southern Fried True Crime was one of my very favorites that I started with. And Erica Kelly would cover a few LGBTQ cases here and there. But no one else really did much with the LGBTQ cases. And I think there's a need for someone to have a show that's just strictly LGBTQ cases. And I found one or two afterwards, but I knew what I wanted to do. And they were shows with more than one host. And I kind of like just the one host. That's mm-hmm. my personal preference. So I decided, yeah, there's a need for it. I'm going to go ahead and try it.
Well, that's great. And what have you found? Because obviously that's a very specific element of research to find the cases that involve that community. And you've been doing weekly episodes now for 5 years. I mean, you're into the, probably a couple hundred episodes you put out so far?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's a lot of cases. Do you have you had trouble finding them, or where do you find your cases?
Sadly, I have not had trouble finding cases. There's a lot, and it seems to be a lot more happening. And I keep thinking, what happens when I run out?
Right.
Well, I do some historical cases, but I do those mostly with my Patreon members. But I'm not in any jeopardy of running out. And sadly. Because our community is constantly getting hit.
Right. So are there more, do you find that there's more cases of the LGBTQ community being the victims of the crimes as opposed to the perpetrators? It seems like that would be the case.
Yeah. And then it seems like most of the perpetrators that are LGBTQ are, it's against themselves, like domestic abuse cases or murder-suicide cases.
So what does a typical episode look like for you? If somebody's tuning in, so it's just you just doing a scripted podcast. So how do you take on? Is it one case per episode?
Actually, I do two. I do a main case, and then I do a true crime quickie because I have a little bit of ADD going. Uh-huh. And it's really hard for me to focus for too long. And the same as a listener of true crime podcasts, if it's over an hour, I can listen, but I have to stop it and I have to go back to it just because my ADD is everywhere.
Uh-huh.
And I'm everywhere. So a typical case for me is kind of a quick one. It'd be 20, 25 minutes. A long one would be 35 minutes for me.
Uh-huh.
So what I would do is I'll look at I'll find a victim. I'll search the victim's name and I'll find a whole bunch of different articles about that victim. And I'll try to cross-reference and find out what facts are mostly talked about in each article. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Because the media does not always get it right. Therefore, I don't always get it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate that. And I wish there were more ways that I could check my facts and cross-reference and things like that. But I'll do my research, I'll do my writing, and I will record, edit, and put out a show and hope for the best.
Do you do everything by yourself or do you have any help?
Oh, no, I do it all by myself. I also run a network. I have a network of about 30 shows right now.
Oh, really? So tell us about that.
It's Darkcast Network, and I have True Crime Paranormal. I have an audio drama, and it's all darkly related type themes, cryptids, conspiracy theories. There's great people, and we're all indie podcasters who support each other.
So did you say that's your network? Did you found the network?
I did.
Okay.
I had a co-founder at one time, but we had some artistic disagreements.
Right.
So she left and I became the sole founder. And I do have some helpers that are great, and they're on the board. I made a board.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't have to do it all by myself, but they're great to bounce ideas off of and things like that.
So what was your background before? Because you said 7 years ago, you never heard of a podcast. And then here you are 7 years later, you have a network with 30 podcasts under it.
Well, I know I'm only 29, but for 30 years, I worked with children.
Okay.
They were ages 5 to 13. And I worked at a very busy school, but it wasn't with the school that I worked. I was running a daycare program on the school campus. For okay. City of Sacramento.
So is this a retirement job for you?
Podcasting?
Yeah.
It's a hobby.
It's a hobby. Are you still working besides the podcast as well?
No. My hobby is my podcast and my dog.
Yeah. What kind of dog?
My daughter, my adult daughter and her boyfriend live with me. And what'd you say about my dog?
I said, what kind of dog is it?
Oh, I just got him. I lost my baby and I carry a little bit of her ashes here.
Oh.
I lost her a year ago in January. And she was Maltese Chihuahua. My new boy I got in July, he's Maltese Papillon. And he's just a ball of energy.
So in your 29 years, you spent 30 years running the daycare.
And I'm now kind of a miracle.
Yeah, right. So you had no background in obviously podcasting, audio engineering, anything like that. So how did you go from, okay, yeah, I like this idea. I think I'm going to start a podcast to where you're at now?
I did have a little bit of video background, but it wasn't like professional or formal training. It was learning through my daughter growing up and working with kids and making videos for them and putting them to music and stuff like that. Audio isn't much different, the editing and stuff.
Right. A little easier, I think, anyway.
Actually, it took me a long time to get where I am with editing.
Yeah.
I used to dread it. Now, you know what part of podcasting I dread? Recording.
I'm the same. I tell my editor all the time, is like the worst part about making a podcast is recording the podcast. I dread it every, like when writing the scripts, doing the research, doing the investigations, the whole thing. I love it. Then I have to sit down and actually like speak the words. And for some reason, that's just grueling for me.
I hear you.
Yeah. I much prefer this. I much prefer like when I'm having a conversation, love that. But when I have to sit down and like read a script, then it's just like something in my brain is just like goes into panic mode.
I have to talk myself into it every stinking time.
Me too. It's like those two things. It's like reading a podcast script and going to the gym. Both of those. I sit at the gym parking lot for like 20 minutes every time when I pull in, talking myself into going in every day too.
I'd rather go to the gym.
Yeah. So you started off, you have just your podcast. And then at some point you add a second podcast when you start to create the network. Like how did that happen? What was the first show other than at the time Beyond the Rainbow? What
was the first founder show?
Yeah. Besides those two, like what was the first one that you added to the network?
We have friends that are podcasters that you meet in like retweet groups.
Uh-huh.
I guess they're not retweet groups anymore.
Yeah.
They're repost groups.
Mm-hmm.
So you start with them and see if they're interested. And then right now we have an application on our website, darkcastnetwork.com, for dark genre shows to go and apply.
Okay. So you guys are just really great. I mean, I've been doing this for 10 years and my network, I've had like four or five shows. Usually they don't last. It always ends up going back to just this one that I'm still doing. So it's impressive that you've been able to maintain that.
It's not easy, Bob. It is not easy at all. People get pod fade and they don't want to do their podcasts anymore. another network might poach them from you, which has happened also. It, you know, stuff happens, but it's great. I've gone to several true crime festivals and I've met podcasters there that I've picked up too and actually have become really good friends with them.
Oh, that's great. Let's take and talk about, maybe we can touch on a few cases that you've covered on the show. Do you have any, most people have a particular case that's just the one that's like their case that's near and dear to their heart that they can't get out of their head. Do you have that case?
I do. And it's because I'm still in touch with the mom. The case is that of 21-year-old trans man, Alex Van Dalsen. He was murdered in Indiana. And the police on their body cam footage said he was placed here and positioned this way. This, you know, wasn't natural. He wasn't murdered here. Then they go and tell the mom that Alex died by suicide. Yeah. Even though on their body cam, it said, no, he was positioned here.
Right.
I don't know for quick work to close the case, not get the parent to react to it other than to feel better that, yeah, he took his own life. So crazy stuff. There was a gun found under him. He had his hands in his hoodie's pocket, but yet he shot himself.
Both hands were in his pockets?
Both hands were in his pocket. The gun was under him. The exit wound, gosh, I wish I could remember more. I did this several years ago, even though I still talk to the mom. We don't really discuss the case much anymore. Mm-hmm. The coroner said that the exit wound, which is typically usually bigger from the entrance wound, the coroner got it mixed up and said that the entrance wound was the exit wound, and it wasn't. Mm-hmm. There's just so much wrong with this whole case. Alex had a girlfriend that he was writing. He wrote a list to return keys to her. He didn't feel like he was good enough for her. Mm-hmm. So return her keys, do this, do that, do that. The police took it out of context and thought it was a suicide note, which it wasn't. And I'm not explaining this very well because I wasn't prepared to talk about it. And I apologize for that.
That's all right.
But yes, that case is probably the most near and dear to my heart. If you get a chance, Alex Van Dalsen, I have had several episodes on it. Look it up. It's heartbreaking to me that this young boy cannot get justice for his murder. He was murdered. He was not suicidal, and he didn't take his own life.
Do you find that working with specifically victims within this community? So you mentioned that you don't know why they just wanted to close the case or whatever. I always kind of go back to that concept, the way I think a fellow podcaster Shane Waters put it, as of throwaway people, that the police maybe look at people from your community. That, well, it doesn't really matter if we solve this case. Do you see much of that, or do you feel like there's a lot of that goes on?
I do see a lot of that. And I know that a lot of LGBTQ people are frightened to go to the police because of that mentality. But on the other hand, I do also know that at least the larger cities with police communities, they're trying to incorporate an LGBTQ, I can never say this word, liaison. That's a really hard word for me.
I think you nailed it.
But they're trying to get a contact who is gay, a gay police officer, to mend that gap between the police and the LGBTQ community. It's going to take a while. And one person's not going to be able to do the whole thing. But hopefully it'll get better. And small towns, they need to do something like that, too. It's the bigger towns and the bigger cities that are doing that.
Sure. So in Alex's case, first of all, what year was Alex killed?
Oh, I want to say 2021.
Okay, so it's recent. And is anybody doing anything with it? Or have the police just declared it a suicide?
No one but Alex's mom. Alex's mom has been trying to pressure government officials into reopening the case. And they just won't do it.
What part of Indiana? I'm right on the Indiana border, so I'm curious. What part of Indiana is it?
Okay, the name is fleeting from my head. I knew it so well, too. It's a funny name, and it's a county.
There's one of those by me. There's Kosciuszko County is by me. I don't know any of the other ones that aren't right here.
I wish I could remember. I'm so sorry.
Well, we'll be able to look it up. I'm just curious how far away, if it's near here, because I've never heard of it, and that seems to be a lot of times. And I think that some of the value proposition from what you're doing is, it sounds like cases like that are cases where no one ever hears about them. They don't get the press for the same reason that we were just talking about a minute ago. It seems like, you know, I'm literally a stone's throw from the Indiana border. I've never even heard of that case. Teresa in the chat said it was from Lafayette, Indiana.
Okay, in the Lafayette area, yes.
Yep. Yeah, and so that's not far from me. Isn't it, Lafayette is where Purdue University is and that?
What's the county there?
I'm not sure.
That's the name I'm having a hard time remembering.
Yeah, I'm not sure which county that is. But also, so Teresa also had a question earlier. You mentioned that you're still in contact with Alex's mom.
Yes.
Do you reach out to the victims' families?
Not always. And it's come back to bite me in the ass.
How's that?
Well, okay, maybe it hasn't. Here's what actually has bit me in the ass. Reaching out to a parent whose son went missing overseas. I told her I would like to cover your son's case. Would you be interested in talking to me about it? And she came back hard at me and very angry and said, no one can tell his story like me or his family members. So no, but you're going to do what you want to do anyway to make your money. And first of all, I kind of giggled in my head thinking, make my money? Okay, there's probably no money in this lady, but okay, let's talk. So, you know, I kind of told her who I was. I gave her my real age, told her about my child and, you know, how I would feel if my child ever went missing. And, you know, kind of took it from there, kind of de-escalated her a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, I've seen other people have covered her son's case. So.
Right. Yeah, that's always tough because there's a lot of media out there that just kind of gets surface information, will put stuff out and tries, then doesn't make those contacts and they don't get it right. And then it turns people off from the media in general. I've had cases that I've gone into work and, you know, they'll be resistant because they're like, well, the last people that came in and said they wanted to do our story completely butchered it. And so they didn't want anything to do with that ever again. Do you ever do interviews on the show, or do you just talk to families, is it just for background?
Well, what I was going to type you before we started being able to chat, I have a new laptop. My old laptop, nobody could hear me. So I stopped doing any interviews. I had a few. My very first interview was Bill Thomas, whose sister Kathy was part of the Colonial Park murders.
Oh, really? That's interesting.
Yeah. And he was very gentle with me and walked me through how to interview someone.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out okay, I think.
Yeah. Well, I love what you're doing and how you're like, this is, you know, after your whole career, that you're just going into this full force and you know, learning all these skills and everything. You know, most podcasters, I tell people all the time, like, most podcasters aren't from media. Like, most of us, especially indie podcasters like us, are, you know, we're learning as we go. It's an, you know, I was a fireman before I did this.
You know? Oh, wow. That's great.
Yeah. I had zero background in this whatsoever. And there's just so many people like that, so many lawyers now that are doing podcasts and things that are just doing great work. And, you know, as time goes on, they get, you know, they evolve. You get better equipment, you get better microphones, you learn how to interview better. And, it, you know, over the years, it just, you know, those skills build. But I like that. And I can assume if somebody goes through and listens to from beginning to end, all your podcast episodes, they'll hear that evolution.
Oh, I hope so. I actually tell people start at the end and work your way backwards to the beginning.
Right. So you already like me by the time you hear the shitty episode that I did at the beginning. That's what I tell people.
I think my first three seasons were my shitty episodes. I sounded like I was in a race. I was trying to get through it really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard not to, when you're new at reading a script, how to not go real fast. Plus, as we've pointed out, we don't like reading the script. So it makes you go even more faster to hurry up and get it done.
I have a drama background too. You'd think I'd like the scripts.
Oh, right. Yeah, but it's probably a little different though, right? You know, in a dark room by yourself in a closet somewhere than on stage in front of people.
Yeah, my dark room's my closet. I'm back in my closet, Bob.
Oh, you went back in.
I did. Only for the podcast, though. Right. Taking one for the team.
Right, then right back out afterwards. Do you really record in the closet?
Out. I'm sorry?
Do you really record in the closet?
I do.
So many.
Not right now. I'm not in a closet. I'm downstairs in the living room because the adult children are upstairs still asleep.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're in California, so you're on. You're a few.
No, I'm in Oregon. Actually, I used to be in California.
Okay. It's so funny. So many. I had another show that I did for a while called True Crime Binge, where I interviewed a lot of other podcasters like this years ago, and it was, I would say, 80% of them. Some of them really big podcasts record in their closet. Like the closet is the best place to record.
I used to sit on my bed with a blanket over me.
Yeah, so that you don't get the echoes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
I'm glad those days are over. I actually have a table now that I can work at.
Right, that's awesome. Have you ever worked any LGBTQ wrongful conviction cases?
I have. Actually, two of them I did that I can remember. I did one about a black trans man named Kai Peterson, who shot and killed her rapist, who was on top of her at the time. Was this in Georgia? Or yes, she lived in Georgia. And she had been to a convenience store, and some guy had made and I'm going to say she right now, and that's not the correct pronoun for her, because she is a he now.
Uh-huh.
But going back, she was a lesbian before when I first covered the case.
Okay, gotcha.
Now she's a trans man.
Okay.
She was in a convenience store, and some guy had made an off-colored comment about wanting sex with her, and she just ignored him and walked out. And she was walking home to her mobile home. The guy apparently followed her and knocked her into a vacant one, and he got on top of her and started raping her. And this had happened to her before, so she had a backpack she carried with her. Somehow her brothers went out to look for her and found her, and they were going to attack the man, and they didn't get a chance to, but I think they pushed him a little bit, and she got into her backpack, and because of her previous attack, she carried a gun, mm-hmm. and she was able to shoot the attacker. In court, her brothers turned against her. I think they were fearful they were going to get sent to prison.
Mm-hmm.
And they said all sorts of terrible things about her. And she was convicted of murdering this man when it was really self-defense. And then she was released about 9 years later, I want to say.
With the conviction overturned?
After they figured it was a wrongful conviction and it was self-defense.
Yeah, I mean, that's like the exact definition of... Like, even if you take any, like, firearms training and concealed weapons classes, the times when you're allowed to use deadly force are when somebody is in danger of being physically harmed, assaulted, or sexually assaulted, which is, like, exactly what was happening. Like,
right, as it was. But it was Georgia, and she was a woman of color,
mm-hmm.
A lesbian. I find that cases in the South are harder for the LGBTQ community if they have committed the crime.
Yeah, that's so sad.
That like they are bad people.
Yeah, I keep circling back to it, but that idea of, you know, the throwaway people that, you know, they don't matter, especially like you said, down in the South, especially where anybody that doesn't fit the mold maybe is not, you know, there's not as much priority given to them, whether they're a victim or a leniency to them when they become a defendant.
Yeah, I agree with that. There was another case of another young black woman. She's a lesbian. Can't remember the state it happened in, though. But she was falsely accused of killing an older gentleman who was a war veteran. And he was outside mowing his lawn. And two young people approached him trying to rob him. And he's all, get out of here. Oh, go away. And they ended up shooting and killing him. And this girl named India Spellman was arrested for it, but she wasn't the one who did it. It turned out it was another girl, and I don't know if they ever found her or not, but the boy that was with her pointed out India Spellman as his accomplice, and that's how she was arrested and convicted for the crime. But she eventually did, she did get released from a wrongful conviction.
And so you've covered up to date over, how do you know the exact number of episodes you've done?
No, it's over 250 though.
Over 250 episodes, and that's that. And you said two episodes or two cases per episode. Like, that's incredible to me that you've been able to track down that many hundreds of cases that all involve your community.
Yeah. Too many. Yeah. And there's so many more. And I have to tell you, there's a lot of trans cases I haven't even covered. There's a ton of them.
Well, are you going to be getting into those in the future?
Maybe. There's just not a lot of information on them.
Right. That's, yeah, that's got to be tough if there are cases that you're trying to highlight them, but if nobody's highlighted them yet before, it's hard to find the information, I'm sure.
It really is. I personally, in my podcast, I like to tell a little bit about the victim and what type of person they were. What were their dreams? What were their aspirations? And that is so freaking hard to find out there.
Right. Yeah. And I love that too, that you put that focus on the victims, that that's the reason that, you know, I'm doing this. The reason you're doing this is that we're trying to, you know, give people their voices back. So I really appreciate what you're doing. I haven't, you know, I came across your podcast. I listened to an episode and immediately reached out to you because, you know, in this season, we're trying to just, you know, highlight other content creators that are doing, you know, good work in the space. And I think that, you know, highlighting this community and putting that information out there and shining a light on it, I think is worthwhile. So I'm hoping a lot of my audience will go over and check out Rainbow Crimes, and you can hear CJ's 250 plus episodes and 250 more to come.
16.
Yeah. Season 16. We're on season 16. That's great.
Are you really?
Yeah.
How many episodes do you do a season?
Oh, that just depends. We've done over 1,000. We're like 1,100 episodes, something like that. See, because we do long form. My episodes are, my seasons are long form investigative series. So sometimes it's 30 episodes. We've had one that's been over 60 episodes. It just depends how many we do. And we do two episodes a week.
My seasons are much shorter. I only have 15 episodes per season.
Yeah.
I had to stop somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes sense to have just a nice clean number on it. Well, CJ, it's been wonderful meeting you. And thank you for coming on. And hopefully all our listeners will go check out Rainbow Crimes. Thanks so much. And hopefully we'll chat again sometime.
Well, thank you for the invite. I appreciate it, Bob. It was very nice to meet you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music for Season 15 is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kaywood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.